Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with behavioral economist Robert Frank about the very timely ideas in his latest book, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. And you can learn more about Robert and his ideas through his Twitter feed, and that's at EconNaturalist, at EconNaturalist, at EconNaturalist. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. There are 85 days until what has long been called Election Day, but if you're thinking of voting by mail, with the post office now led by a Trump crony and hit hard by the loss of business mail, I think we'd be wise to give ourselves at least a two-week margin. Try to vote by mail by October 20th. And I encourage you to get involved not only with candidate campaigns, but also with efforts to fight voter suppression and assure that all Americans get their right to vote, all the more challenging in this time of pandemic. And as we confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you also to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, and by finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation or the economic devastation that's now unfolding. And finally, as we continue to make our voices heard against racism and police brutality and for justice and inclusion, please do your part to keep this campaign alive. Whether it's showing up on the streets or helping with organizing or fundraising or just taking on the deep reflection or habit building in your personal life and with those closest to you. Now to today's conversation. Why can't we beat the damn coronavirus? Why is it so hard to get people to wear masks? We currently face two critical situations where our personal circumstances are highly dependent, if not determined, by the actions of others, mostly others we will never know or meet. This November, the President of the U.S. will be chosen by the actions of voting-age citizens in approximately 55 counties, in particular swing states in this country of 340 million. And the votes cast by the 35 million in my home state of California will seem to mean nothing. And until there's a successful vaccine campaign, a successful vaccine, and a successful strategy and implementation plan to actually get that vaccine to people all around the world, the lifespan and virulence of the pandemic will depend on the behavior of people, as I said, that I will never meet. Will they wear masks? Will they socially distance? In situations where our personal health and well-being is dependent on the behavior of others, it makes sense to ask, what influences their behavior, and how do we influence it in our desired direction? Psychologists have long understood that social environments profoundly shape our behavior, sometimes for the better, often for the worse. Robert Frank's latest book, Under the Influence, is subtitled Putting Peer Pressure to Work. And he makes the case that the economics of social contagion could solve our most critical problems, from climate change to income inequality, and from the viral contagion that we all face these days. Vox's Ezra Klein says, I'm quoting here, absent the pandemic, its argument might have seemed abstract, optimistic. But now we've seen it happen. We are watching a version of Frank's thesis play out right now in real time. In the wake of coronavirus, social pressure has driven perhaps the single fastest behavioral transformation in human history. So while I want to know how to get everybody to wear a mask, we can't ignore the enormity of the social changes that we've all taken on over the last 4 months. Robert H. Frank is the Henrietta Johnson Lewis Professor of Management and Professor of Economics at the Samuel Curtis Johnson Graduate School of Management at Cornell. And yet, Robert, I'm going to cut in for a second. That's in all your latest bios, but you retired in July. So is that still true or not?
I am retired as of July 1.
Okay.
Got out just in time.
So he was that professor. Now he is that former professor. He's also a distinguished senior fellow at Demos. For more than a decade, his economic view column appeared monthly in the New York Times. His books include Luxury Fever, Money and Happiness in an Era of Excess, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class, Success and Luck, Good Fortune and the Myth of Meritocracy, and his latest, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Welcome, Robert Frank, again to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Nice to talk with you again, Terrence.
Okay, the last time, as I mentioned to you off air, was 2007. We've both been at this a while. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Monday, August 10th. First of all, how are you doing? Where are you? Where do you live? And how are you coping with the pandemic?
I'm living, as I have been for many decades, in Ithaca, New York, a picturesque upstate town in the state of New York, the home of Cornell University. I am well and healthy. I'm suffering a bit of survivor's guilt. I'm able to work from home without any difficulty. I've got a good income. There are so many people whose lives have been seriously disrupted and ended by what's going on these days that those of us who are largely insulated from the worst of that really need to be grateful.
Absolutely.
My youngest son, however, is an EMT here in Ithaca, and so he is on the front lines, and we worry a lot about him. So far, everybody's healthy, though.
Very good. Very good. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So briefly, how do you see your path? And this must be sort of interesting at a moment of, not a moment, but sort of a moment of retirement. How do you see your path to the work that you do today? And you can go way back, mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
As an undergraduate at Georgia Tech, we're talking about 1966 now in my senior year, there must have been unusual circumstances. Maybe some people died or left unexpectedly, but they invited me to teach a freshman math class.
Oh my!
In the spring term of my senior year, I'm sure they would be embarrassed for me to be telling that story publicly, but I did it. I got very good reviews from my students. I loved doing it. It was such a thrill. I was responsible for everything in the course. And I decided on the strength of that experience that I wanted to be a teacher. I had at the time been a math major, and I didn't think I wanted to go on and get a PhD in math. My next stop was 2 years in the Peace Corps in Nepal. And it was quite common for volunteers at that time, probably still, to want to study development economics. We were in the poorest country on earth. Then it's still one of the poorest. And so I applied and got accepted to graduate programs in economics, came back and studied economics. So that was really the experience that launched me on becoming an economist. And I think the thing that shaped my thinking most as I think about economic issues was the experience in living in Nepal. It couldn't have been more dramatically different in material terms from what I'd been used to here. I mean, the house I lived in had two rooms, no electricity, no running water. It was very, very modest circumstances. And the striking thing was within 48 hours, all of that seemed completely normal to me. You know, if you lived in a house like that in the U.S., your kids wouldn't want their friends to know where they live. They'd be ashamed. I would be ashamed. It would be a signal that you had failed miserably somehow. In that environment, it was totally fine as a house. In fact, it was nicer than the house that most of the colleagues I had in the high school where I taught were living. So just seeing that life played out in more or less the same terms, even on a dramatically different material scale, was something I think most people probably feel like they know in the abstract, but to actually live that for a couple of years lets you know that in a way that I don't think I would have known it otherwise. And so I think the insights I've brought to the study of economics have revolved in large measure around that experience. You know, I think the standard economic models that say that it's the absolute qualities of the things we have that matter. So if you're talking about houses, it's the number of square feet, the number of bathrooms, and so on. Those things matter up to a point, but beyond a point, it's one we've passed long ago here, further increases in those things don't do much more than shift the bar that defines what we consider adequate. If all the mansions were to double in size, the rich people who live in them wouldn't be any happier or any healthier than before. And I think the framework of thinking about it as if those absolute qualities matters just leads us down a whole variety of wrong paths. Mm-hmm. We spend our money in a whole host of ways that doesn't do much for us, and neglect to spend it in a host of other ways that would really matter.
Yeah, no, I think it's you know, you certainly I often ask that initial question of my guests, and so often some experience at about that formative time you're talking about, just post college, you know, really sets the course for the rest of their life. And it's so sad to me, as you say that, to think about, you know, the vast millions of Americans who won't ever get that experience. You know what I'm saying? That the Peace Corps is not the attention-getting entity that it was for a couple of decades, and that sort of thing, and so many Americans who never even leave this country or their home state.
Yeah, I do feel fortunate to have had that experience, but there are other routes to that end, and reading good books can get you a long way there.
Yep. I found a quote in an interview you did that I thought also described, in other words, you saw how that sent you on a certain path, but you said that you have been thinking about ways to expand the common economic model for a long time, that we pursue a much broader range of aims than the rational economic model would suggest. That is another sort of almost umbrella way of describing your career, isn't it?
Yes, I think for a long time, I was with Dick Thaler here at Cornell when mostly Dick Thaler, who is Richard Thaler now, he's the 2017 Nobel laureate in economics, founded the behavioral economics movement, which has become an enormously influential body of thought within the profession. The main thrust of the work in that movement has been that people aren't the savvy rational actors they're portrayed as being in the models. They make mistakes, not just when the problems are hard and they don't have enough information. People get things wrong even when the problems are simple and they have everything that they need to solve them right there in front of them. So mostly the behavioral economics movement has focused on mistakes that people make and the consequences of them and how to avoid them. The branch of that movement that's been my focus is different from that. It's on the fact that we don't pursue the narrowly selfish aims that are generally assumed of rational actors in our models. We care about fairness. We care about how context shapes our perception of whether a thing is desirable or not. And because we pursue different aims from the ones the models assume, the conclusions about how best to arrange our affairs and institutions are wildly off the mark often. And so I think it's a whole laundry list of situations where you could call it Darwin's central insight, the insight by Charles Darwin, that it's not how smart you are, it's not how fast you are, or how inventive you are that matters. It's how those qualities compare with the same qualities in those you compete directly against. So it to achieve what you're after in life, relative performance is really the key thing to focus on. And I think once you adopt that focus, we see all sorts of situations where the invisible hand idea breaks down. This is the Adam Smith notion, or at least it's one attributed to him. His modern disciples are much more enthusiastic about it than he ever was.
That's right.
But according to them, you turn selfish individuals loose in the free market and tell them to pursue your own ends, and automatically they're led as if by an invisible hand to pursue the greatest good for the greatest number. And sometimes that does happen, as Smith saw. So entrepreneurs will bring out cost-saving innovations, not to help society, but to steal market share from their rivals, and that's a good strategy, or quality improvements, same argument there. And then the ball doesn't stop there. Others see that they're losing share to the rivals who've brought out these improvements. They copy the innovations, and you get a dogfight. And when the dust settles, you see cheaper, better products available for everyone, and the producers earn just enough to cover their costs. It's a great story when it works, but it doesn't always work. That's the main thing, which is that when position matters, you get just fundamental conflicts between what it makes sense for me to do and what it makes sense for us to do. So you stand up in front of me at an event to see right. better, then I can't see. I stand up too, people behind me. Soon we're all standing. None of us sees any better than if we'd all remain comfortably seated.
Yep.
We're not irrational to stand. We don't regret standing. It's the right thing to do individually, but collectively, it's stupid. We if we had some means to coordinate with one another, we would agree to sit down.
Yeah. And the other thing, I don't want to pursue this one, but the other thing that as you're describing that situation where the entrepreneur comes up with a lower priced product and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and it's, you know, now cheaper and maybe more convenient for the consumer, one of the issues I heard just as you were describing that is, yes, but what about the worker? And what about the environment? And it's that sort of thing that there's these other people affected by all of our actions that even more so might not show up in that in that macro where we add up the individual goods. Now, I first became aware of your work with the book Luxury Fever. And the example from that, Robert, that I cite the most is the one of comparing the value, the relative value of a masterpiece painting and an excellent view out the window. And so you can lay that one out for people. But what I was going to say is, I saw one reviewer who feels that the new book, Under the Influence, is a departure where you had been diagnosing the ills of keeping up with the Joneses, especially the 1% Joneses. In this book, you take the same human tendencies and recommend using them for good. So first, just to set a little foundation, and you began to do it actually in your previous answer, but if you want to flesh it out anymore, the kind of earlier work you were doing in Luxury Fever and Falling Behind.
Yeah, I think my first reaction is to repeat the advice I give to junior colleagues who want to study how other people's behavior affects their own spending. I tell them, don't use the expression keeping up with the Joneses. That makes it sound like people who are insecure, who are trying to put on airs and appear to be better than they really are or have more money than they really have. And I think most people feel on introspection that they don't care about keeping up with the Joneses, so this must not be an important phenomenon. I think the right way to think about it is that it really doesn't have much to do with that at all. It's just that when we ask whether something's good or bad, attractive or unattractive, you can't even think cogently about a question like that unless you have a clear frame of reference. Mm-hmm. So is my car fast? Well, if it would have gone up as high as 60 miles an hour eventually in the 1920s, it would have seemed blazingly fast, no matter how long it took to get there. Today, if it won't get to 60 miles an hour in under 6 seconds, it seems sluggish. So you always have to take into account the surrounding frame of reference to understand how we evaluate things. The house I lived in Nepal was another clear example of that. It was just as nice as a house could be in that context. I didn't aspire to have a better one. Nobody would have. If I lived in that house here, I'd be ashamed for people to know I lived in it. If my friends in Nepal could see the house I lived in here, they would think, why would I have taken leave of my senses? Why would I need such a grand palace, so many bathrooms? Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't think that. No, people here don't think that. So it's all about frames of reference and how we evaluate things. And That fact leads us to spend our monies in ways that don't really serve our purposes. So that's one form of influence of context, but the context could be a good influence too. So if you want to eat a healthful diet, if you want to exercise regularly, if you live amongst people who eat junk food all the time and never get any exercise, you'll find it's harder for you to do those things too. If you live in Boulder, Colorado, where one of my sons lived, mm-hmm. you'll find that unless you go out and exercise every day, you feel like you're a laggard. And unless you eat whole grain, organic foods, you're doing poison to your body. So different environments create different frames of reference that induce us to behave in different ways. Sometimes, as you put it, for the better, but often for the worse. And I think the psychologists have long known that. They say it's the situation, not the person. And by that they mean when we see somebody do something, our impulse is to say, well, what kind of a person would do a thing like that? And we think about traits of character and personality. No, that's not the right way to think about it, they say. Better to look at what the social circumstances were surrounding the decision to act in a particular way. That's the real heart of most explanations of behaviors. And so that's long been known. It's not controversial. It's also not controversial, and it's less often remarked upon, though, that the social circumstances that surround us, that influence us so strongly for both good and ill, those are themselves a consequence in the aggregate of the individual things we decide to do. So the causal arrow goes from the environment to us, but also from us to the environment. That second causal arrow direction is one we almost always ignore completely. Why should I worry about my effect on the social environment? Because my individual action has such a minuscule impact on it. I'm not going to worry about that concern at all. So the trick then is to get people to think about how their social actions will affect the environment, how their individual actions will affect the social environment, and provide them with incentive to act as if they cared about that.
Right.
It turns out it's easy to do that. And yet we don't do that in most instances. We just ignore that link entirely.
Yeah, well, you point out that the real harm, or the more important harm that a smoker produces, is not so much the secondhand smoke that affects those who come within, close to him, but it is leading others to smoke.
Exactly. So if you're worried your daughter's going to smoke, it really doesn't tell you anything to know that she's a science fiction fan, to know that she's a fan of the LA Dodgers, or she likes Shakespearean dramas. That doesn't predict anything about her likelihood of smoking. The one factor that matters more than anything else, and it's a huge effect, is the proportion of her close friends who smoke. And if that number were to rise, say, from 20% to 30%, she will become 25% more likely to either become or remain a smoker.
And that number that you just said, by the way, I think is worth repeating almost, because if someone is considering 10 friends as your close network, to go up 30% means that 1.5 of them
right, yes.
have taken up smoking. And
yeah.
yet your chance of taking up smoking goes up 25% just with that one person picking up smoking.
Exactly. There's no other effect that comes close to that. Now, we didn't start really regulating smoking seriously until there were Japanese studies that appeared showing that secondhand smoke exposure was harmful.
Yep.
We've long adopted the view, I think we can trace this to John Stuart Mill, really. The only legitimate basis to tell somebody that she can't do what she wants to do is to prevent undue harm to others. To protect her against harming herself, that's not a satisfactory reason to regulate her. So we accept that view. I think that's a more interesting question, actually, than Mill had any way to realize. Maybe your 50-year-old self has good reasons to wish that some regulator had kept him from doing something stupid when he was 20 that's now coming back to shorten his lifespan. Set that to one side. It was only when it was shown that smoking harmed other people, innocent victims who had no recourse, that we felt justified in regulating smoking. We started taxing it and telling people they couldn't smoke in various places. The real harm you do is not from secondhand smoke exposure to others. That's a harm, yes, but it's a minuscule harm compared to the harm you cause by making other people to become more likely to become smokers. That's a vastly bigger harm. A lot of people thought, well, that's not the government's business to tell you whose behavior to imitate, whose to avoid. Okay, I like the sentiment that motivates that objection, but you know, we have parents who are doing their best to raise their kids to be non-smokers. They do everything within their power to achieve that goal. What we know is that if there are more smokers out there, millions of parents will fail to achieve that perfectly laudable goal. Their kids will grow up to smoke. If they try too hard to prevent them from doing that, they'll make them more likely to smoke. So, So it's a huge cost that people impose on others by making them more likely to smoke. And without that contagion effect, there's no way the measures we took would have had anywhere near the success rate that they've had. It used to be more than half of men smoked when I was a teenager. Now it's 12%.
Describe that piggyback sort of feedback loop thing of regulation and contagion.
Yeah, regulation and tax incentives can do only so much directly. Cigarette smoking is one of the most highly addictive habits out there. The friend of mine who had once been a heroin addict told me that it was much easier for him to have quit heroin than it was for him to have quit smoking cigarettes. The tax wouldn't dissuade most people who are already smoking from giving up their habit. They're too wedded to it. But there are some who are at the margin. They'll quit. There are some who have a little bit more willpower than others, they'll quit. There are others who were thinking of starting and who now, because it's more expensive, won't start. Even if there's a few in those categories, that means every peer group they belong to now has fewer members in it who are smokers. That means every other member of those peer groups are less likely to become smokers or remain smokers. So then we have fewer smokers still and so on. And it just keeps amalgamating until we see this huge reduction in the aggregate smoking rate. And I think nobody looks back on that history and said, oh, why did we do that? Why did we reduce the smoking rate from 50% to 12%? What a terrible thing we did. Everybody's delighted at that outcome. And there was nothing illegitimate about the steps we took to get to it. It's totally fair. It's totally efficient. It's totally morally justified. To tell somebody you have to pay a penalty if you behave in ways that cause harm to other people.
Yeah, what's interesting, one of the things I find interesting in that is that, as you point out, we're especially in America with our individualism and so on, we're loath to do something for your own good, to regulate something for your own good.
Right.
But we will do it if it harms others. But it's like we draw some sort of line between physical harm and social yes. harm.
Yeah, if you want to know the most important point that I think lurks in this discussion, it's that harm is harm.
Right.
Harm occurs in your head, whether it's if somebody hits you over the head with a baseball bat, you're harmed, you experience harm. If somebody causes you or influences you to behave in a way that's harmful to your health and well-being, you're harmed that way too. And we don't have any basis for saying one kind of harm is important, the other kind of harm is unimportant. I like the idea of holding people responsible for their actions. So as a parent, I tell my kid, you're responsible not to copy the stupid things you see your friends doing. Yes, of course, we should tell our kids that. But does that mean I don't care about what their friends do? I know that their friends are going to have an enormous influence on them. And if there were relatively low-cost levers we could pull that would cause their friends to behave in ways that would influence them in a more positive direction, why not pull those levers?
Okay, so we've established that that this social contagion works. The more with obesity, the more obese your friends and network of workers are, and so on, the more likely you are to be obese. Smoking, we've talked about that the same. Likewise, positive. We assume positive things the more you're around, so, and we'll talk about it later. But what I wanted to jump to was something which I know if I don't ask it now, we'll run out of time, and that is these same tendencies must be at play in tribalism, that we do what others do, but in tribalism or political division or cult behavior, only the ones in our group, and we oppose what others do if they're in the other group. Can you talk a bit about how that fits in the context of what we've been talking about?
Yeah, I think the basic phenomenon is that we have, it has to be an innate impulse to be influenced by what others do. You know, the world is pretty complicated. I know very little about what I would need to do to know in order to get through it in the best possible way. You know very little also. Together, though, we know quite a bit about the world. And so I think if any of us saw a group of people behaving in some new way and didn't have at least an impulse to investigate whether it might make sense for us to do that too, we'd be woefully ill-equipped to make our way in the world. So that basic impulse is, I think, quite widespread and common across people we know and people we don't know. Another basic fact about social evolution has been that there have always been in-groups and out-groups, and it mattered very much to be in a group with whom you were allied because there's strength in numbers, and so having a team that's willing to go to bat for you and that you can cooperate with was always a big part of succeeding in the world. And so when we see people who are on our team doing things, we're naturally much more influenced by that than when we see people on the opposite team doing those things. Maybe we're even inclined to do the opposite of what we see people on the opposite team do, because often our interests are in opposition to theirs. So yeah, that's the very key point that explains why we've become so disjointed in our response to the coronavirus. We've got one team telling its members not to wear masks, that you're a sissy if you wear masks. The other team, following much more closely with the scientific evidence on the question, is telling its team members that wearing masks is the most effective thing an individual can do, perhaps, to avoid catching or transmitting the virus. And so we've got these two polar camps. And since we can't avoid bumping into one another, that's a recipe for widespread failure. We've seen how badly things have played out.
Yeah, no, I mean, it strikes me, and I'm certainly not the only one. This is, I know Yuval Noah Harari says that we face three existential threats, and he wasn't even talking about the pandemic, which was nuclear war, climate change, and maybe some sort of technological disruption, and that all of those depend on cooperation and collaboration and cohesion, and yet we see culturally, not just in the U.S., but also in other countries, division rising to toxic levels and so on. And how, I mean, when you take a step back and look at what you're suggesting as a positive use of social contagion, but when you look at it within that context, what's is there a path forward that social cohesion might help us find?
Well, sometimes there are questions that are just hard to resolve, and so we can go for a long time mired in disputes and disagreements about how best to proceed. And I think we were for a long time in a situation like that in the United States in particular. There were people saying, no, climate change is a hoax. It's not really happening. And if it's happening, it's a natural process. We're not contributing anything to it. And so there's nothing we can do about it. I think that view has pretty much been accepted as false by I won't say by everybody, because that's obviously not true, but by a very substantial majority of the population. Now the question is, what do we do about it? And I think as we're seeing the clash between these opposing approaches to these large-scale collective action problems play out, and how unsuccessful the one side's response to the coronavirus pandemic has been, we're actually poised, we're on the cusp of what may be a very rapid and significant transformation of how we do business. I think there's a very good prospect that in the short term, we will cast aside the viewpoint that doing nothing is the right thing to do, and that we've got to take cooperative and concerted collective action in order to deal with these problems. And if so, that will be terrific news, because there are simple steps that we can take that will be enormously effective.
Yeah, and I myself thought that in the face of the pandemic, that the size and sustained effort of the Black Lives Matter protests was to some extent a result of the shared vulnerability that we were feeling towards the in response to the pandemic, and so we were more likely to feel a shared vulnerability to George Floyd's vulnerability.
That has to have contributed, but also just the vividness of the way in which he was murdered, I think, captured people's attention in a way that nothing before had managed to do, and then the months of brutality in the streets, I think, and the testimonials, the images of peaceful protesters being shot in the face with rubber bullets and blinded and tear gassed into, you know, several people have been killed and seriously injured through all this. It's really galvanized a big shift in public opinion. I mean, most people come into the world not thinking about most issues most of the time. They don't know what to adopt as a position. And so mostly what people do is they adopt the position that other people seem mostly to have adopted.
It sounds like what you're saying is that we might be at one of those inflection points where there's hard-fought division. And as you say, if something fails spectacularly, my guess is that for those who are absolutely dug in and for whom their tribalism is almost cult-like, it won't make any difference. And that's where Trump's early and consistent claims of fake news help, that if you can get all of your information from a certain bubble, you might never notice the spectacular failure, even if people in your neighborhood are dying. But that those who are not quite as confirmed in that tribe, that's where we might see a shift.
Yes, yeah, so those will be the people whose loyalty to the tribe is most fragile. And you have to reckon with the fact that this is an unprecedented failure. Every other prosperous country in the world has dealt successfully with getting this virus under control. We are conspicuously outliers in all of this. The number of infections, the number of dead, the disorganized messaging, the lack of leadership at the national level, all those things are unlike anything we're seeing anywhere else in the world. The economy is in a hole deeper than any since the Great Depression, maybe even more deep than that, since now the pathways to coming back are many of them closed. We can't go out and start things up successfully. There's been a huge attempt to get the schools started again in the fall. The early attempts to do that so far are turning out to be the predicted failures. The notorious school in Georgia where the viral photo of the crowded hallways was circulating, now 9 confirmed cases of COVID in that school alone. So they're going to try to open the schools at great insistence that it's the right thing to do. That move will fail. And so I think we really are on the cusp of an inflection point, a position from which one person will abandon the ship, that will lead somebody else who was teetering to abandon it too, and then there was somebody else who's threshold of loyalty was a little higher, but also near the brink that that person will bail out. And so we'll see a great unraveling. And once there's a big enough tip in the political sentiment, then the door becomes open in a way that it hasn't been in decades for considering other ways of doing things.
This is interesting. So it strikes me, and I remember when I was listening to an interview of yours and you were talking about solar panels, it almost sounds like the same sort of exponential growth of the virus.
Oh, it's exactly the same idea, in fact. So there's an influential study done early in the cycle of solar adoption in California. So a family just at random installs a set of solar panels on its rooftop on day one. What the authors were able to report was that within 4 months' time, on the average, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less, but 4 months later, there would be a copycat installation in the same neighborhood. Somebody would see the neighborhood who had done that and be influenced by having seen that to do it herself. She does it, so now we've got two installations after 4 months. Each of those continues to spawn copycats. So after 8 months, we've got four. It keeps doubling every 4 months. And so at the end of 2 years' time only, we've got that first installation has exploded almost literally into 32 new solar panels in that neighborhood. And that's not the end of the story, because each of those 32, they're talking with friends and relatives and other locations, those people are going to be even more influenced than they are by neighbors. And so we'll see the spread go from there. So you do one, that's not the end of the story. It's a huge multiple of that initial direct effect.
And that's why it's called contagion.
Exactly.
Yeah. No,
exponential contagion.
Which, as we're saying, is what is going on with COVID-19, but which we have the potential to do with all sorts of good behaviors.
Yes.
And that solar panel one is just great, because that is not, it may be easier than quitting smoking, and it may be easier than changing your eating habits, but it's not inconsequential.
It's a big deal.
It costs money. It changes the way your house looks and feels. It's a big family decision that has to be reached.
Right.
And yet there we see it laid out. So I was going to talk a little bit more about studies that confirm this, but that one just does such a great job. I'm going to leave it at that. You talk about that at certain point there might be a turning point, and I'm led to remember The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. And I believe I've seen a statistic that in an S-curve, a few people are doing something, a few people are doing something. When you reach 7%, that curve has a chance of changing direction enormously and shooting up from there. I don't know if that number, it rings a bell for you. There's another, yeah. a book by, well, research and a book by Erica Chenoweth, Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. I don't know if you're familiar with this one.
Yeah.
But you are, yeah. But she finds that at 3.5, she and her partner in that research find that at 3.5%, when 3.5% of a population begin to protest or demonstrate, that change is almost inevitable.
Yeah, it's a remarkable set of forces, and it's not just the raw percentage of people who are on a different side of an issue, it's who they are that matters too. So I think in the research on bullying in schools, the social scientists who study that dynamic report that when a student in the school's social network who is socially, centrally located takes a stand, a publicly visible stand against bullying, that has enormously more influence on behavior in the school than if a less popular student makes the same pronouncement. So yeah, it matters who is voicing an opinion or taking an action of a specific sort. But yes, it can be very modest beginnings quickly mushroom into something quite big.
Yeah, and I think we talked about the response to the killing of George Floyd as being A, that it came at a moment when we were already feeling like we were more similar because of the pandemic than we might normally. And then also, as you pointed out, it was that we all actually witnessed his death because of video, because of social media, that we all, and the internet, we all actually witnessed his death and the particularly gruesome, cold-hearted nature of it.
Yes. Yeah, all those things, I think, combined to make it a hugely influential event.
Yeah. And it's so, I mean, to me, I think when we look back on this, what will be fascinating is that the pandemic created an atmosphere where that was likely, but at the same time, it created an atmosphere where you were risking your life, perhaps, to protest, and yet people did.
Yes, and I think the fact of having taken those risks cemented people's sense of how important it was what they were doing.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that. Yes, that absolutely, the step out your door those days was a different decision than to step out the door without the pandemic. And so your commitment to your own decision is that much greater.
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about something which I think spans a lot of what ails us as a society, whether it's infrastructure, education, public health, all of which, by the way, one could say are contributing factors to how poorly we've done on the pandemic. But you say that the mother of all cognitive illusions is that is one that the wealthy hold about raising taxes. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think the starting point is that if we had spent our money differently, we would have been in a much better position to deal with the problems that are staring us in the face now. So it's not that nobody predicted there would be another pandemic. In fact, that was what kept President Obama up at night. That was what kept George W. Bush up at night. Bill Gates said it was the main worry on his radar screen, too. And this pandemic, bad as it is not the worst one that any of those men imagined that we would have to deal with. And so if we had been truly responsive to that concern, we would have been prepared to spend vastly more money than we did spend on medical research. We're now launching crash programs for vaccine development. We could have done those programs 10 years ago and been much further along in the process. We have a private healthcare delivery system that essentially doesn't reward the holding of surge capacity in the system. So we don't have additional ICU beds, additional ventilators in case of emergency. That's not part of the business model. We could have been spending to provide surge capacity. All those things we could have spent money on. That would have meant spending less on other things. And here's the magic bullet. Because there's a large and very careful literature on the determinants of human well-being. And the main finding in it is that beyond a certain point that we've long since passed in the US and other rich countries, further increases in most forms of private consumption just raise the bar that defines what we feel we need. And so all the extra spending that's been prompted by the income gains at the top of the income ladder on more expensive wedding receptions, bigger houses, more expensive cars, all that extra spending has mainly served to raise the bar that defines what we expect. It doesn't make us any healthier or happier. If we had taxed the people who've gotten the biggest gains in income over these past decades and used that money to refurbish our infrastructure and invest in public health, we'd have been in a much better position today. Why didn't we do that? And that's where the illusion that you mentioned comes in. People at the top don't want to be taxed more heavily. In fact, they've used every lever they can pull politically to prevent that from happening, and they've succeeded in actually reducing their tax rates over the last decades. So what I call the mother of all cognitive illusions is the belief that motivates them to do that. They're not worried they won't be able to buy what they need if their tax rate goes up. Of course, nobody has a proposal on the table that would threaten that ability. What are they worried about then? They're worried about their ability to buy the special extras in life that they want. Those things, which are in short supply, typically, There's only one car that can claim credibly to be the fastest or the best handling, for example, or one penthouse apartment with the most sweeping view of Central Park. There are a limited supply of these special extras, and people think they would be handicapped in their ability to get them if their taxes went up, but that's just a cognitive illusion, because the way you get those things is you have to bid against other people like you who want them, and your ability to succeed in those bidding contests depends only on your relative bidding power. It doesn't depend on how much absolute income you have. It depends on how much income you have relative to the people you're bidding against. And when your taxes go up and the people like you see their taxes go up too, your relative bidding power is the same as before. And so all those special things end up in exactly the same hands as they would have if taxes had not gone up.
Yeah, and you point out an interesting thing in the way people think about these sorts of things, because, you know, these are to a great extent smart people, and yet they make this error. And you point out that many of them, if they search for a time when they had less income, when there was some chunk taken out, it might be because of a bankruptcy or a company failing or these sorts, or a terrible health situation or so on. And the difference that you point out is that that only happened to them. If that same thing had happened to everyone, it yes. wouldn't have affected their buying power.
No, that's exactly the source of the illusion. You know, the natural way to think about how a tax hike would affect you is to try to think back to the last time they raised your taxes significantly. How did I feel then? That's a great strategy, except it doesn't work in the current environment because tax rates at the top have been going down steadily over time.
Exactly.
You know, there were 92% in World War II when I graduated from college, 70% when Reagan was in his first term, 50%, now 37%, a couple of little increases along the way. So you can't think about how higher taxes would affect you in the natural way because you haven't had that experience.
Right.
So what you do instead, as you point out, is just try to think about all those times you had less money, because sure enough, when the taxes go up on you, you have less money. And the times you can remember are mostly times when you had less money, but everybody else had the same as before. And those were bad times for you, yes, but that's not what will happen when your taxes go up and everybody else's taxes go up.
Right. And I just love one quote you have here. Who's happier, someone who drives a $333,000 Ferrari on roads whittled with foot-deep potholes because there's been no money going to infrastructure, or someone driving a $150,000 Porsche on well-maintained roads?
And yeah, no contest.
Even your wealthiest, most ego-insecure person would go with the $150,000 Porsche and the infrastructure.
Yeah, and many wealthy people say, oh, I'd be happy to pay taxes if I thought they'd spend the money on useful things, but they'll just waste it. And so they say, oh, they'll crown hundreds of welfare queens
mm-hmm.
every month. They'll build bridges to nowhere. They'll take money out of the public purse for their own private use, blah, blah, blah. All of those things do happen. But if you look at any government budget, a big share of the total dollar expenditures go for roads and bridges and schools. So some of the money, if you pay more tax, is going to go for the things voters care about. And the question is, who's happier? Somebody who has good public services and a little less private consumption, even though everybody else has less private consumption too, or somebody who has bad public services and more private consumption in an environment where everybody has more? So that's an easy question.
Let me give you 2 minutes to, we talked about we might be coming, and this is going to be we're getting to the end here, but we talked about that there might be a big shift coming out of this pandemic. And so what is the Robert Frank plan for how to use social contagion to make the most of that?
The training I got as an economist made me friendly to the idea of giving people incentives to behave differently as opposed to commanding that they behave differently. And so I think we saw how well that worked in the smoking arena. We didn't tell people you're forbidden from smoking. We restricted smoking in certain places, but we didn't outlaw smoking. We said Smoke if you must, but since you cause harm to others, we're going to charge you a penalty for doing that. And through contagion, that produced an enormous change in the population's behavior relative to smoking. We can copy that basic blueprint in arena after arena. We should never be taxing behaviors unless those behaviors cause harm to other people. That's the fundamental insight of the contagion theory, that you can steer people toward outcomes that are better for everybody just by giving them very gentle incentives to move in a different direction. Let me close with an example of the carbon tax. It's true,
yes. Yeah.
As many people have said, that it's too late for a carbon tax to be the only measure that we adopt in response to global warming. If we had done that from the beginning, it would have been enough. It's too late for that to be enough now. But that's no reason not to adopt one. People say, oh, the poor, last thing they need is an extra tax on energy. We should adopt what economists call a revenue neutral carbon tax. That means we take in all the revenue from a carbon tax, which is a tax on fuel at the point it's either extracted or imported. That tax makes carbon intensive goods and activities more expensive and gives people incentive to engage in them less frequently. And we would say we take all the revenue from that tax, most of which would come from wealthy people. Worldwide, 50% of all emissions are due to the top 10% of income earners.
Wow.
So most of the revenue would be coming in from wealthy people. Even if we gave the revenue back to households in lump sum monthly checks, most households would get a check each month that was more than they'd paid that month in carbon taxes. So they'd be net financial beneficiaries. We could rebate the revenues even more progressively than that, so it would be very easy to design a scheme where 90% of all families would get more back each month than they had paid in carbon taxes. Each family still would have an incentive to shift away from carbon-intensive activities to less carbon-intensive ones because they could save money by doing that. So think about people who eat meat. Why do we eat so much meat? Well, I eat so much meat because I grew up among people who ate a lot of meat, and I still spend a lot of time among those people. If meat got more expensive, that would produce a very small change in behavior. But people at the margin would shift away from expensive meat products to plant-based products, which would be relatively cheaper. It would become then the custom when we entertained to eat less meat-rich diets, and so it wouldn't be socially unacceptable to serve guests a less meat-rich diet. And as each person did that, that would make the door a little wider open to a further step along that path. And pretty soon we would go from a very meat-heavy diet to a diet that's much, much lighter in meat consumption, and that would be a huge reduction in emissions because meat production is one of the most energy-intensive activities out there.
Very good. Very good. So we can see that, that an intervention, and as we said before, it's linking that higher price, which incentivizes a shift in behavior, to the power of social contagion, which then replicates and exponentially increases that shift.
Yeah, the social contagion insight is that if you push even a few people a little bit in one direction, that ignites a prairie fire that makes a much, much bigger change in the end.
Okay, so again, the book is Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work, and you can learn more about Robert Frank's ideas and thoughts at his Twitter feed, at EconNaturalist. That's at EconNaturalist, at EconNaturalist. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or A World That Just Might Work, all one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, plus usually 8 or 10 articles that flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and at most other major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site or at those others. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Robert Frank, and keep up the good work.
Great to talk with you, Terrence.
Okay.